Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our online and radio audiences. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein tonight, the author of Plato at the Googleplex. Rebecca was trained as a philosopher of science, and she received her PhD from Princeton University. She's the author of 10 prize-winning books of both fiction and nonfiction. Her first novel, The Mind-Body Problem, was written while she was a young assistant professor of philosophy at Barnard College, and that went on to critical and commercial success and launched her in her second career as a novelist. She's been named the Humanist of the Year as well as Free Thought Heroine and received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundations, the American Council of Learned Societies, the Radcliffe Institute, and others. In 1996, Goldstein received the MacArthur Fellowship, commonly known as the Genius Prize, for her ability to, quote, dramatize the concerns of philosophy without sacrificing the demands of imaginative storytelling. The prize committee went on to say that Goldstein's writings emerge as brilliant arguments for the belief that fiction in our time may be the best vehicle for involving readers in questions of morality and existence. And in her latest book, she imagines Plato coming back to the 21st century, and how would he deal with it? Thank you very much. Welcome, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Well, when you write a book that's devoted to one thinker, a lot of people assume that you think that thinker got everything right. And I certainly don't think that's true of Plato. He got about as much wrong as you would expect of a man who lived 2,400 years ago. And it's not just science that, of course, he got wrong. There wasn't really even science back there. It's proto-science. He got a lot of philosophy wrong. And it's very hard to read Plato without sometimes feeling great disapproval, moral disapproval. He never thought to question slavery, for example. In fact, the Greeks didn't really have an idea of individual rights. Aristotle didn't have it either. This is really an idea that emerges in the Enlightenment. So why write a book about Plato? I don't know. I'm trying to reason. I wanted to use Plato to think about the role of philosophy, whether it still has a role in our lives in this world of, you know, neuroimaging and the multiverse and cognitive science and evolutionary psychology and Googling. Is it still with us? And it seemed to me my tactic should be to, one, go back to the beginnings of philosophy and try to figure out why it emerged when it did, and why it happened there in ancient Greece, which is something I've always wanted to try to figure out. Why Plato did it. And Plato, it's not that he came up with all the answers, but he came up with a good number of the questions. Philosophy is, of course, divided into many subspecialties. For every area of inquiry and human concern, there's a corresponding philosophy of that. Philosophy of language, philosophy of history, philosophy of mathematics, philosophy of science, philosophy of art, philosophy of religion, philosophy of education. What am I leaving out? Political knowledge itself, epistemology, morality, of course, ethics, and metaphysics, but anything, really any kind of area that you can think of, there is the corresponding philosophy devoted to that. What do all these questions have in common in virtue of which they're philosophical? Plato had an incredible nose for the philosophical question. He inherited a certain subset of philosophical questions from Socrates and others, but he is really the one who expanded the entire terrain of philosophy. He kind of gave the lay of the land, or the metaphor that I most like to use is he It's as if he raised the sunken continent of Atlantis up, the whole continent of philosophy, which is a particularly apt metaphor to use because the first reference that we have to the myth of Atlantis came from Plato, right? He writes about it in the Timaeus, or Timaeus, depending on how you pronounce your Greek, and again in the Cratylus. So he was something else. But the Greeks were something else. In some sense, their culture was primed for philosophical questions, and that's one of the things that I try to ferret out, to explain, to discover for myself in the book, where it came from, why it happened there, and what in particular was true of Plato. Plato is a very remote figure. We don't know all that much about him, and it's not just the antiquity. It's not just that he lived 2,400 years ago. It is the style in which he chose to give himself to us. He didn't write treatises. He didn't write inquiries. He wrote dialogues, and his dialogues are very great literature. And there are characters. There are real characters. In fact, here's just something I have to say as an aside. When I was writing this book, and the question people always ask me when I'm in the midst of writing a book is it going to be fiction or nonfiction? And then when I would say, well, part of what I'm doing is writing these philosophical dialogues using Plato in our day, the response was always, oh, so it's fiction. And I thought, well, what about Plato? That's how he did it. And that is part of what makes him very remote. It's very hard to figure out what he's saying, if he actually even wants to put forth any doctrines. But the questions are there, and also he's very, very relevant to this other question, this contemporary question that I wanted to take up, which is, what's the fate of philosophy? Philosophy is always having to argue for its right to exist. In the old days, it was the philosophy naysayers usually came from religion, one oughtn't to try to answer by reason what can only be known by revelation. Nowadays, the philosophy naysayers, those who say there really isn't such a field, it's soon on its way out, maybe it's already gone, come from science. You get this argument much more from scientists. Lawrence Krauss, a cosmologist, was quoted saying, that philosophers used to have something to say back when physicists were all philosophers, when they were called natural philosophy. But in the 16th, 17th century, when physics really developed a methodology and broke off from philosophy, all philosophical progress stopped. You hear this a lot from the brain sciences, neuroscientists, cognitive scientists, evolutionary psychologists sometimes, that philosophy is what it is a kind of holding station, or it holds down the fort, right? It asks the questions, keeps the questions alive and out there until the cavalry arrive, right? The scientists, and until the empirical methodology catches up, and then it's taken out of the sphere of philosophy and progress can be made. And in fact, there's some truth to that. If you look at the history of philosophy, many questions, including physics and cosmology, were first posed by philosophers, psychology too, human nature, the nature of human nature. Is there such a thing as human nature? Became an empirically answerable question. Psychology, computer science, logic itself, artificial intelligence, all of these started in philosophy, and then they break off, and then, great progress is made. So my question was, one, is philosophy still around? It seems to me it is, and it's not just in the academy. Far from it. I hear people speaking, questioning, putting forth philosophical questions all the time, including the scientists who are saying that all is science. That's an epistemological claim. It can't be answered scientifically. Philosophy is all around us. When I was just in New York on this book tour and I was being interviewed, and the interviewer went off to the restroom, and I, of course, have to eavesdrop at the next conversation, and there are these two women talking, and it comes right out of my chapter 4. They're talking about how to raise their children and what values should we give our children, and should we try to make them be happy or successful? And it's a philosophical question, certainly a question that Plato took up. There are philosophical questions floating around everywhere. People don't always recognize them as philosophical, but they are philosophical. So there was that question. Try to identify these philosophical questions. Are they going to be answered by science? Are we biding our time until the scientists catch up? And the third question, have philosophers made any progress? Scientists make very obvious progress. Has progress been made in philosophy? And I wanted to use Plato for all of this, right, to go back into the ancient Greeks, discover why they asked this peculiar kind of question, and then to bring Plato forward the way he brought Socrates forward. And when he wrote his dialogue, Socrates was already dead. He uses Socrates in a way to bring him forward into his own development, Plato's own development as a philosopher of genius. Somebody wanted to bring Plato forward into our day. And the other thing I wanted to do as a way of demonstrating the vitality of the questions that he discovered was to use as much of what that man had actually written as possible and to interweave them into these contemporary dialogues that I was going to write. And that was a chore. It required that I basically memorize all 26 of the dialogues, and some of them are extremely long. The Republic is very long. The Laws is very long and often quite boring. A lot of Plato's quite boring, in fact, but when he's good, he's so good. But I wanted to be able to have the relevant passage accessible to me and to be able to weave it in such a way that if I wasn't putting it in parentheses, my readers wouldn't know that it actually was written by somebody 2,400 years ago. And I've have had so much fun doing that I haven't been able to give it up. I now am tweeting as Plato. It's called, my handle is at Plato Book Tour. And my publishers had always, I have not used social media very much. A bit of a Luddite. And my publishers have always tried to get me to, you know, use Facebook or to tweet or something. And then my brilliant daughter, who's actually here, she lives in San Francisco, said, knowing her mother quite well, said, well, would it interest you to tweet as Plato? And of course, yes, right? And so he's with me. He's here in this room. He'll have much to say afterwards. He might comment on some of your questions. I was in New York last week, and I was at a weird social event I found out I was mentioned in the social diary, sort of the high society diary, and I was identified as not a philosopher, novelist, but as a philanthropist novelist. And Plato just thought that was hilarious. He couldn't stop tweeting about that and quoting Socrates from the Apology, which is Plato's version of Socrates' trial, when Socrates was put on trial for the capital offenses of impiety and corrupting the young, and was voted guilty, and it was by vote, and then he was voted that he would die by an even larger majority than had voted that he was popular. And one of the last things he says in that trial, in Plato's version of the trial, is that he's a philanthropist. He's done more good for the Athenians than all the rich people and all the society people and all the politicians. And so, yeah, Plato went to work on that philanthropist, novelist identification. Anyway, so that is part of what I've tried to do here. So I'm to give you a sense of it. I have five expository chapters, mainly about ancient Greek, the extraordinary Greeks, who, you know, went in a matter of 200 years from anomie and illiteracy to Aeschylus and Aristotle. They had literacy under the Mycenaean culture. It was destroyed. They lived among chaos. Did not have an alphabet any longer. They, at one point, as the city-states were being formed, they got their alphabet from the Phoenicians. So it was a Semitic alphabet, and they adapted it to their language, and it was the first adaptation of one-to-one correspondence between symbol and sound. But they had to actually incorporate the Phoenician, to adapt the Phoenician vocabulary alphabet. So they went, they were not just high achievers. They were really on the fast track, right? That's amazing. There was an extraordinary explosion of creativity and inventions, you know, a kind of science, the rudiments of science, certainly abstract mathematics, the study of history, not just chronicles, but history, democracy, right? They invented, and in addition, timeless art and architecture, poetry and tragedy. You know, what was going on there? And what made them so primed to ask philosophical questions? So that is a great mystery, and I try to understand that, and also try to understand Plato, who he was, and what his relationship with Socrates was, and why the Athenians voted that Socrates should die. Athens was a place that really prided itself on free speech, and they executed Socrates for exercising free speech. So why did that happen? But then those expository chapters are interspersed with these dialogues. And the dialogues always relate to something that came before in one of the preceding expository chapter. So here are the five dialogues. So the first place I take Plato is to the Googleplex. And I have given a talk, Authors at Google. It was quite the experience, and I'm going sometime soon. I haven't checked my schedule. Within the next few days, I'm going back to Authors at Google and to give a talk there. So Plato goes there. He's looking for, perhaps the next philosopher king there. And there are quite a few people who seem to want to claim that they are the philosopher king there. And he gets into a dialogue with his media escort, Cheryl, who's a very down-to-earth woman, certainly doesn't seem to have a great philosophical flair, and a software engineer about whether or not ethics can be crowdsourced. And the software engineer is very keen on this idea. Thinks that the only expertise one would really need, you know, a kind of Google algorithm that would just, you know, crowdsource and get you the information, the relevant information using some kind of algorithm, and that you can imagine how Plato reacts to that suggestion, not terribly well. And he really, using things that he actually said, quite dismantles the sophisticated software engineer's idea about, it's called an ethical answer. What was it called? Ethical answer. The acronym was EASE. Search engine. Ethical answer search engine. Yes, EASE. No, it turns out these ethical questions cannot be answered with ease, right? And it's Cheryl who's telling this story. The next place I take him to is the 92nd Street Y. Is this something that? Yes. Gosh, you know, I said it at Yale, and nobody knew. A lot of people didn't know what it was, and here in San Francisco, you know what it is. But he's on a panel with child rearing experts discussing how to raise the exceptional child. And again, you know, he has a lot to say to a kind of tiger mother and a kind of diehard Viennese-trained psychoanalyst. The next thing I have him doing is because the chapter... the expository chapter talks all about love and eros in ancient Greece, and in particular, Socrates' love, and love for, in particular, Alcibiades. I write about Alcibiades at great length because I just find him incredibly fascinating. He was the bad boy of ancient Greece. He was irresistible to both men and women, to the Athenians. He betrayed the Athenians. They kept forgiving him. He betrayed the Athenians to their mortal enemies, Greek enemies, the Spartans, their enemies during the Peloponnesian War. He went over to the Spartan side. Then he betrayed the Spartans and the Athenians by going over to the Persians, you know, who was the great enemy of all the Greeks. And he just lived a larger-than-life life. In some sense, he was the embodiment of something that the Greeks worshipped, which is being larger than life. This is something that this was part of their values. And Socrates loved him. There are jokes and sly little jokes all through the dialogue. So when anybody meets Socrates when he's wandering around, it's like, oh, are you looking for Alcibiades? Or as somebody last night when I was at Harvard Bookstore said, Alcidiabetes. And I thought, is that a joke because he was eye candy? Or, you know? But so the chapter, the dialogue I have after that is called XXX Plato. And what I did was I'm friends with a professional advice columnist. She is herself the daughter of Ann Landers and the niece of Dear Abby. Her name is Margot Howard, and she wrote a column, I think, for Slate.com called Dear Prudence and then Dear Margot. So what I did is I made up questions that I knew Plato would have an answer to because Plato devoted two of his greatest dialogues to erotic love. It was something that interested him very, very much. The Symposium, where Socrates gives that speech from which we derive our somewhat degraded notion of Platonic love. And then the Phaedrus, in which Plato is in a really strange mood. He has Socrates deliver two speeches to this beautiful young boy, Phaedrus. The first one argues against the madness of love, And the second one completely reverses that. Socrates says he's ashamed. He's offended the god, Eros, by his first speech. And he argues for the madness of love, for that kind of transport, erotic transport. This is very odd from Plato. It's not like anything else that we find in Plato. I mean, first of all, to do the two speeches, he's out and out telling you that he's divided. He's a divided soul when it comes to this. And the Phaedrus also reverses his view, his terrible view, his very... never forgive him for this view about poetry. You know, he had banished the poets from his utopia in the Republic. Well, he reverses himself not only about erotic love in the Phaedrus, but about poetry. So much so that by the end of that second speech, he has launched into rhapsodies. It's extraordinary poetry. So he's not only telling us that he's reversing himself about poetry, he is showing us, right? This is wonderful, wonderful poetry. So what is going on there? He's certainly divided. A lot of us think, I am one, that Plato was in love when he wrote that. And being a real philosopher, not just an academic philosopher, even though he founded the Academy, but a real philosopher, if he was going through something in his life that had to be philosophically thought through, he did it, and he would reverse himself on it. And that is, wasn't just, you know, thinking 9-to-5 philosophy. Philosophy was something to be lived. And if there was an experience that was changing his views, he was going to change it. And he was even going to change the style in which he gave it to us. It's still dialogue, but it's poetic. It's true poetry. So I knew Plato had a lot to say about erotic love, and I made up these various questions, and I sent them first to Margot, and because she, like her mother Ann Landers, consults experts. In fact, she consults me when she thinks a question is philosophical. I'm her philosophical expert. But now I have her consulting Plato. And what was really funny is sometimes Plato was more liberal than Margot. And the next place I have him is going on cable news. He's on a show called, every author has to, if asked, I suppose, has to go on cable news. And it's a show called The Real McCoy, and the moderator is Roy McCoy. And they discuss many things on the show. When Plato first gets, one of the things he does at the Googleplex is he gets a computer, he gets a Chromebook, and he quickly becomes addicted to it. That was very useful for me because I didn't have to catch him up on anything. You know, by the end, he's taking MOOCs. You know, by the end, he knows much. Of course, you know, he is addicted to it. And he's very, very excited by the accessibility of all of this knowledge. Information, certainly, but perhaps knowledge, perhaps he thinks in the beginning, even wisdom. And he becomes more and more disillusioned as the book goes on, as he becomes more familiar with our society. And I suppose the height of his disillusionment is when he's on The Real McCoy, when he's on that show. And he feels that instead of the internet opening us up to many different points of view. In fact, in our blogs and our chat rooms, we're actually listening to people who agree with us, and we're even getting our news from news sources that agree with us. And so it's, in fact, not opening our minds up at all. It's actually closing them. And the last place I have him visiting is at a neuroscientist's lab. He volunteers to have a brain scan, Plato, and to be part of the control group. And I volunteered so I would know what it's like. And he, in fact, goes through the same experiment that I did. But before that, he gets into a conversation with two neuroscientists about such questions as free will and personal identity, moral agency. So those are the places, you know, that I bring him to. And I just want to very, very quickly read to you from various of these things just to give you an idea. So, I don't know, maybe I'll start with the real McCoy. I did try to watch Bill O'Reilly in order to do this, but I just couldn't. I just couldn't. So I watched Colbert doing. But, yeah. All right. Roy McCoy. But you should try to hear that voice in your head. I do, right? That Bill O'Reilly voice. All right. Roy McCoy. Okay, so they tell me you're a big deal in philosophy, Plato. I'm going to tell you up front, because that's the kind of guy I am, up front, that I don't think much of philosophers. Plato, many don't. The term attracts a wide range of reaction, from admiration to amusement to animadversion. Some people think philosophers are worthless, and others that they are worth everything in the world. Sometimes they take on the appearance of statesmen and sometimes of sophists. Sometimes, too, they might give the impression that they're completely insane. I just have to tell you, that's a direct quote from the sophist. McCoy, well, I'm going to go with that last one. Just as long as you add that it's the kind of insane that makes right-thinking Americans the world over want to smack you upside the head. Plato, it comes sometimes to reactions even more violent. My friend, the best of men, was charged with the crime of doing nothing more than practicing philosophy as best as he knew how. He was found guilty and executed. McCoy, where was that, Texas? Plato, no, it wasn't Greece, though many years ago. McCoy, I'm sorry to hear about your friend's ordeal, but I have to ask you a question. What was he doing to tick people off so much? Plato, it's a good question. McCoy, since you apparently don't know me, you don't know that I only ask the one kind of question, and that kind is good. So unless your friend was prosecuted under that military junta you Greeks had going on back there in the late 60s, early 70s, Plato, he was brought to trial by our democracy, and in fact it was by popular vote that he was condemned to die, even though the Delphic Oracle had declared that there was no person who was wiser than he. McCoy, yeah, well, I have two Peabodys. Listen, that one always takes a little while. Listen, not to disrespect the memory of your friend, but there's got to be more to the story than what you're saying. You're spinning, and I'm calling you on it. We don't call this the no bull bin for nothing. See, democracies don't go around bumping people off just for being annoying types who think they know better than everybody else, which, from what I can gather, is what you philosophers specialize in. In fact, I have to say, Plato, I haven't spoken to you 2 minutes, and you're already beginning to irk me. But we live in a democracy that protects everyone's right to be a royal pain. Plato, progress has been made. McCoy, debatable. Plato, I am impressed by the progress. McCoy, then maybe your initial expectations were too low. Plato, maybe they were. McCoy, you sure you're a philosopher? You seem a little too ready to change your mind. Or maybe you just don't have the courage of your convictions. Plato, I would prefer the courage of my questions. It goes on. I'm going to read you a little bit from XXX Plato. Here's one, okay. Dear Margot, I wonder if you've ever gotten a complaint like this one. I am engaged to a wonderful man who's highly successful in his field, which happens to be the same one that I'm in. My problem, if you can call it that, is that my fiancé thinks too highly of me. Somehow he's gotten an inflated view of how talented and brilliant I am, and no matter how banal a suggestion I make is, he infuses it with profound insights. Most of the time, these insights are really his own, loosely inspired by some half-baked thing I've said. Sometimes he takes my opinions so seriously that he uses them to challenge his own views and ends up proclaiming that only I could have seen through his fallacies. All of this makes me nervous, most of all because I think that eventually, after his infatuation wears off, which it's bound to do, right, he's going to see me for what I am and feel he's been deceived, which of course he has been, even if the deception is really self-deception. On the other hand, I have to admit that it feels great to be so valued, and I've gained a lot more confidence from hearing myself praised to the skies by someone I so respect. It feels so good, in fact, that I never correct him and just accept the credit and compliments as if I deserve them. What should I do? I love this guy to bits and don't want to lose him, not now and not in the future when his fog of love lifts off. Yours truly, teetering on pedestal. Dear Top, the idealization, oh, so this is Margot. This is what she wrote back to me. The idealization of you by your fiancé has several components, not one of which has anything to do with you. Accomplished though he may be, he doesn't sound as if he has much self-confidence. An offshoot of this is that, to feel important, he must partner with the most brilliant and insightful woman, making you a reflection of his superior taste. Now that he's built you up with his compliments, and because you wisely see reality, I think a heart-to-heart is in order about the whole issue. If you initiate it now, you will greatly diminish the chance for him to arrive at these conclusions himself later on, to your detriment. What I recommend is essentially to set him straight. Admit that it was wonderfully flattering to have him consider you his intellectual and solution-oriented superior, but such is not the case, and you do not want this to go on any longer. Point out that he became a success before you arrived on the scene and that you really are equals, complementary and inspiring to each other, no doubt, but equals. I thought it would be interesting to check what a philosopher had to say about your predicament and went right to the top, and consulted Plato. And I have to admit his take is quite a bit different from mine. Here's what he has to say. Quote, "The dynamic that you describe, Top, seems to me altogether characteristic of love. To be in love with a person is to see reflected in that person all the values we most idealize. This is how it comes to be the case that, in the lover's special sight, the one who is loved is bathed in a radiance of significance that sets him or her apart from all others that exist. Of course, such an incomparable radiance is a delusion, but it is a delusion inseparable from love and love's desire to want all good to come to the one we love. Your lover's perception of an intelligence in you that you yourself don't recognize is an indication of both his love for you and his love for intelligence. And I think you will agree that both of these are good. But there is even more good to be derived from his loving delusion, since it is, by your own description, mutually beneficial. He is being led on to ever better ideas by perceiving them as coming to him through the filter of you. And you, Top, are coming more into your own, as your confidence grows. This, too, is characteristic of lovers at their best. When they gain their wings, they shall do so together because of their love. So my advice to you, Top, is don't even think about setting him straight and getting him to see you as you really are, since that would be inconsistent with his continuing to love you. Love has no truck with seeing straight, and for this reason is sometimes spoken of as a divine intoxication. Rather, continue to flourish in his tipsy sight so that the unrealistic way in which he sees you corresponds over time more and more to the way that you really are." Unquote. So there you have it, Top, Margot continues, two very different responses to your quandary, one from the romantic Plato and the other from the pragmatic Margot. Sign Margot realistically. And I'm going to stop, but I'll just read you very briefly the introduction to Plato at the 92nd Street Y. This was the invitation from the Y. "Join us at the Y for what promises to be the highlight of the season. Zachary Burns, beloved columnist for the newspaper of record, will lead a discussion on how to raise an exceptional child. With Zach will be best-selling author Mitzi Munitz, author of Esteeming Your Child, How Even the Best-Intentioned Parents violate, mutilate, and desecrate their children. Sophie Z, best-selling author of The Warrior Mother's Guide to Producing Off-the-Charts Children, and Plato, best-selling author of The Republic. So anyway, I'm going to stop. I just to give you an idea of Plato in our day, and I would be very happy to take your questions.
So I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein speaking about her new book, Plato at the Googleplex, and who would like to ask the first question?
Oh, would Plato in his wisdom manage in his ability to change his opinion from pro to con, back again perhaps, the seemingly undividable conquest of the Fox News watchers preaching to the Fox News watchers and the NBC, MSNBC news watchers preaching to those watchers?
Yes.
Will there ever be a crossover in Plato's mind?
Well, first of all, the actual man, Plato, changes his mind so much that what you learned, as these are Plato's views, you know, in Philosophy 101, doesn't do justice to Plato. He is constantly changing his mind, not just about romantic love. If there's one doctrine that everybody associates with Plato, it's a theory of forms, you know, that these universals, love, beauty, truth, exist as paradigms and particular things come into being by participating, emulating, imitating these non-spatio-temporal abstract entities. Plato subjects the theory of forms. He comes out very strongly in The Republic and in the Phaedo, which recounts his version of Socrates' death, and could not possibly be Socrates' death because the theory of forms is put into Socrates' mouth, and this is Plato's idea. This was not Socrates' idea. So you know, he's a fiction writer, is our man Plato, but he comes out very, you know, this is where he develops the theory of forms. In the Parmenides, he subjects the theory of forms to stringent criticisms, foresees many of the criticisms that Aristotle brought against the theory of forms. And depending how you date the dialogues, and there's tremendous scholarly disagreement of, you know, which came first, which were the middle, which were the end. But depending on how you date them, there's the way I like to date them, it's probably true that after the Parmenides, he does not refer to the theory of forms again. He gave it up. The thing we most associate with Plato, he gave it up. He certainly in the Timaeus, he has a different notion of what the intelligible is. It's mathematics. It's really not the theory of forms. It's a more developed view, and in fact, was very, very important in the 17th century to the founders of the Timaeus, to the founders of physics. Galileo and Kepler referred to, always when they mentioned Plato, and they mentioned him quite a lot, to the divine Plato, and it's because of the Timaeus. So he changes his mind a great deal. And I think, you know, that is part of what he's doing in the dialogue, that he thinks that these peculiar questions, we have opinions about them, and that our opinions about them are emotionally fraught. They have a lot to do with the way we think of our lives. You know, he says in the Phaedo, to philosophize is to prepare to die. You know, these are human questions that we all of us care about tremendously, and they're also emotionally fraught. And so it's hard to change one's mind, and if there's any hope, it's in dialogue. He tells us in the Phaedrus and in the seventh letter, if that's veridical, a lot of scholarly disagreement about that too, but that he doesn't think philosophy ought to be written down. Philosophy, he mistrusts writing philosophy. It's a lived conversation. And the reason it's a lived conversation is because our deepest opinions are so emotionally fraught and our whole sense of ourselves is formed around them. The only way to examine them is to bring them out there in public dialogue where they'll clash with others. And it's in that kind of living clash that philosophical progress can be made. And so it's dialogue is so very important, lived dialogue. And that's probably the most important reason that he wrote in dialogue. That's the next best thing. But he worried about writing it down. He didn't want anything to be hardened, to become doctrine, to become then an excuse for not thinking anymore, right? For having a doctrine and developing it, but not rethinking your assumptions. And that's why he worried so much about writing it down. So at first, you know, he's very excited, as I was very excited by the internet and the possibilities for this very wide dialogue. But he becomes more and more disillusioned. Surprisingly, he comes to hold the same view that I do, which is that that we're not talking, you know, to each other. We're not listening. We're not airing our deepest assumptions to those who would oppose them. We hate hearing. I hate hearing. I hate reading certain newspapers because they challenge all of my views, and therefore I force myself to do it, but I hate it. I think it's a very, very common experience. Psychologists have done experiments on this, and we all want to have our views validated. So, yeah, Plato worried about the democracy in his day. He was not a great fan of the democracy of his day. And he sees our democracy is much better than Athenian democracy. But he is very worried about this, about especially our not getting our news sources from objective sources. So, and I think it's a real problem, you know, that that he points out. He's very insightful. Yes. Back there. Oops, sorry.
So in assuming the character of Plato, did you find yourself entertaining or espousing any views that you actually disagree with?
Oh, yes. You know, Plato is maddening, first of all, to read him. You know, there are so many things that, when it comes to art in particular, he's such a, not just did he banish the, you know, the poets, but, I mean, his views about music are terrible. He mistrusts human nature tremendously, and the whole idea of the philosopher king is, you know, part of, you know, the rulers have to be philosophers, and they have to be those who are born with certain characteristics that he outlines in the Republic, and then subjected to intense training, 10 years of advanced mathematics alone, you know, to purify them. He wants to make sure that all those who rule don't want to rule. They're also not allowed to own private property. He has a lot of views about how money corrupts democracy. He has a lot of views about campaign finance reform, actually. I actually tried to create a Plato that I could like. The real Plato often drives me crazy. I try to, you know, somebody asks me, well, how did you, you know, what characteristics went into it? They're real characteristics of the man. But I tried really to give him what I thought, since this is really supposed to be an argument for the value of philosophy, its continuity into our lives, its relevance in our lives, and its value in our lives. So I tried to give him what I take to be the voice of philosophy at its best, right? Which is not always the voice of academic philosophy, but of the spirit of philosophy at its best. And he is very, very willing to listen to others, which I don't think was really true of the real Plato one. And he has has an open mind. He changes his mind about many things. Cheryl, the media escort, is able to change his mind about common people and what their potential for philosophy is. He is insatiably curious, open to knowledge. He's not a stranger to sadness, to tragedy, but there's a certain playfulness and joy in him, joy in certainly in knowledge and in being and gratitude. And these I take to be, the best characteristics of philosophy. So he becomes, actually starts as a prig, and in the first one, which is kind of what he often is, and he becomes something very, very different over the course of the dialogues. I came to like him more, because I was creating him, really, my modern character. But the other thing that I do in these dialogues, which might strike you as rather contrived, but Plato's dialogues are quite contrived, that one of the things that I do is that the people who interact with him, no matter what level they're on, become richer. They become more complicated. They see things from an enriched point of view, and that certainly is something that I'm trying to say, that to engage in philosophical dialogue is to become, internally richer. And so there are these changes that occur, throughout the dialogues. But certainly, yes, in my view of Plato too, I quite grew to like him. Yes.
So what did Plato think of the brain imaging experiment he participated in, and how does that compare to what you thought when you participated in one too?
Yes. So Plato has a dialogue with two neuroscientists. One is actually a graduate student who works in this lab, and the other is the head of the lab. I call him Dr. Choquette. No laughter. So Choquette, kind of means in Hebrew a ritual slaughterer. And and the graduate student is named Agatha, and Agathon, of course, means good in ancient Greek. So he is a Dr. Choquette is a kind of not terribly sophisticated reductionist. If you can't find it on the level of the neuron, it doesn't exist. And in fact, so if it's not there, either the 100 billion neurons or the 100 trillion synapses, then it just doesn't exist. And so he's willing to do away with not only, such notions as free will, but the very notion of a person, of decisions, of intentions, of living a life, and that you own as your own life. And Plato actually has something that I got straight from the Phaedo to say to that. Plato has, I give it in Plato's language, and then I translate it into sophisticated neuroscience because Plato's been studying neuroscience. He's been taking a MOOC, and he knows quite a lot. And it's almost the same argument, and for this non-reductive view, for this extreme reductive view, and Plato by translating this into, you know, by my translating this into neuroscience, scientific language, is able to actually, you know, have something to say with the to this neuroscience scientist. I myself never didn't really change my mind about this. I've been a non-reductive materialist since I was a graduate student. My PhD dissertation was on called the message was materialism without reductionism. So, I just want to say one other thing, which is really surprising to me about Plato. We all associated with him with a sort of dualist view. You know, there's the body and there's the soul. And in many places, talk about Plato, refers in many places, he does talk that way. He's not a materialist. In the Timaeus, which is just such an amazing dialogue, he's a materialist. He locates the mind in the skull. His student Aristotle said it's the heart, but Plato said it's the skull, and he had very good arguments. It's the marrow in the skull, and the marrow in the skull is connected to by pathways to marrow and all the bones, and that's how, you know, of course he didn't know about nerves, but that's how messages are relayed. That's how you can decide something in here and move your hand because of the marrow that connects them. So he's actually there kind of a materialist, and even more shocking, he talks about people who do evil, and it's a continuing theme in Plato that nobody willingly is evil. Nobody wants to do evil. And in the Timaeus, he says that people who do evil have something wrong. They have something wrong with their brains. That they are they are ill, and that they should not be punished. We should prevent them from doing bad. We should get them off the streets. But that in fact we don't punish people for, you know, having bad physical diseases. We shouldn't punish them for having. So it's an incredibly progressive viewpoint for a man 2,400 years ago. And that came as a total surprise to me. I had not paid enough attention to the Timaeus. It's an extraordinary dialogue. So that is a view that one would never, you know, associate with Plato in the way he's usually taught. But there he is putting forth a very, very progressive view of mental illness. Could we take one more question?
Henry Markram has this blue brain project in which he takes one CPU to simulate each neuron in a cortical column, 10,000 neurons, and he says he can scale that up eventually to simulate an entire human brain and all the firings. And this is very detailed with the structures of the neurons, the distribution of the ion channels, all the dynamics.
Yeah.
But it struck me that at that point, you would have a lot of data, and you still wouldn't be able to answer the question, what is inside this thing?
Yeah.
Is it feeling something?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same question you're stuck with if, you know, I'm talking to you and I don't really know if you're a zombie or not.
Right.
Right? Or vice versa.
Right. Right.
What's the answer? What can philosophy say about that?
I'll tell you what my Plato says about it. I know, exactly. Yes, we still would not know. And I'm not going to read it. But almost exactly that setup in this conversation with the neuroscientist, you know, and he said, you know, imagine that it's complete, and we have all of these numbers, and you know, it's being projected into a computer, so we have a simulation going on. Would you be able to explain a person's actions as well as you can by engaging with them and asking them their reasons and having them, account for themselves? Would you be able to get out that same kind of information by looking at all of this data? imagine it as complete as possible. And, you know, Plato says, you know, it seems hard to imagine, but, you know, considering all of the technological advances that I've seen in my 2,400 years, it's not all that hard to imagine. Would we be able to understand what's going on as well as we do using, it's a question of level of analysis, right? A chemist could argue that there's no science of rivers, you know, that the geologists, with all of their laws about rivers and like a curving of a river, that the outer bank breaks down more than the inner bank, or maybe it's reversed, I can't remember. But there is some law about that. That none of that can be accepted as explanation, because at the chemical level, you don't see rivers, right? You don't see, you know, you see molecules interacting with each other, but there's no, you can't derive from that these laws of rivers. And it's a mistake of analysis. And so, yes, of course, everything that's going on is a matter of neurons and synapses, but that doesn't mean that we're going to get out the information from that. And that's, so Plato agrees with you about that.
All right. Well, we can actually have one more question. Somebody else?
What would Plato's take be on modern-day Greece?
On modern-day Greece?
Yes.
Oh, poor Greece. Yes. He would have said that they should have listened to him about the philosopher king, I think. That's a great demonstration of his political views. Yeah, I don't know. He would not be very happy about it. It's chaos. I was in Greece, you know, while I was writing this book, and you know, it's kind of heartbreaking to see a place that has given us so much. What has happened there? But I just on a brighter note, because it's depressing. Actually standing there in the ancient agora and thinking about what would it be like to be there, what would it be that Socrates used to wander that agora. And basically, I mean, I have a whole theory as to why the Greeks invented everything, but specifically philosophy. But the gist of Socrates' questions, the reason finally the Greeks decided that Socrates must die, that he was intolerable, was that there was a great feeling of Athenian exceptionalism. Athens and Greece in general had a culture of, I call it the ethos of the extraordinary, that you had to be extraordinary, that you had to achieve mattering in this life. You're not born into mattering. You have to achieve mattering. And the way you did it was not by getting the attentions of those gods. That's the last thing you wanted. Their society was drenched in religious rituals, but mostly those rituals were trying to prevent the gods from paying too much attention to one, because something terrible always happened if a god paid too much attention to you, right? Something, I mean, at the least, a rape, but, you know, could be a lot worse. And turn into a cow. I mean, you know, it really bad stuff. So they were not taking the path to mattering of another Mediterranean people who were thinking out their ideas at just about the same time. Over there across the Mediterranean on the other side of the Jordan River, right, the Ivrim, from the word for over, because they're on the other side of the Jordan River, who were trying, you know, who did approach this question of how to live a meaningful life, a mattering life, in transcendent terms eventually. The Greeks approached it in strictly secular terms. You didn't want to attract the gods' attention. What you wanted to do was attract other people's attention. They were a celebrity culture, just like us, right? So anything you could, you know, great beauty, for example, was worshipped, you know, because that got attention, or great, you know, rhetoric, or warriorship, warfareship, whatever, being a good fighter, being a great athlete, right? This was worshipped. Anything where people would talk about you and there would be a mental replication of you, of your life in other minds and therefore make it bigger, was valued. It was called kleos, which is fame and acclaim. Of course, most people are by definition ordinary, and so the way the various city-states solved this problem, but particularly Athens, was you were extraordinary simply by virtue of being an Athenian. We, you know, created democracy. They participated in, you know, every male citizen who wasn't, you know, a citizen, not a slave, and not a woman, participated in this. You made the decisions, and it was this glorious culture, imperialist culture, but glorious culture, you know. And what Socrates was really saying to them is, no, this is not the solution. You don't matter by being an Athenian. The unexamined life is not worth living. Now, they could tolerate that when they were riding high, the Athenians, when they were an imperial power. But when they lost the war in 404 BCE to Sparta, and their democracy was dismantled, and Sparta, you know, so beneath them, you know, was occupying them up there on the Acropolis, as soon as they got rid of the occupiers and established their democracy again, the very first thing they did was to put Socrates on trial. When they were up, they could tolerate somebody. He was just part of Athenian superiority, you know, that he was such a jokester and you know, asking these questions. But when when they were defeated, they were not going to tolerate Socrates telling them that they did not know the first thing about how to live a life that matters. And that's when they killed him. Oh, and the thing I say about being there in Greece and being down there in the Agora, and you look up at the glory of Greece, it's still there, right? That Parthenon and, you know, all the buildings that still remain, and it was so much more glorious in those days. So for this little ugly man, Socrates, you know, would wander around, you know, ugly, was, you know, they worship beauty, he's ugly, wandered around the Agora in a not terribly clean chiton, barefoot, to be telling them, you're not great in the shadow of the Acropolis. You get a different impression of it, and what that took to be saying that. When you stand there in the Agora and look up at, you know, what remains of that glory. That's when it really hit me. That's why they killed him. That's why they decided he couldn't live.
That's a great end to a great lecture. Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thank you.
I know you know this, but we'll all be talking about this. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 112th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming. If you'd like to buy Rebecca's book, it's out in front. Thank you very much.